Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. I'm going to begin tonight, because of the nature of the study that we're getting into, with some statistics. The number of unmarried adults in our society in 1970 was 37 million. The number of unmarried adults by 1993 had jumped to 72 million and climbing. Now, not every single person remains single, so often they get married. Here's the catch. By the time they are ready to get married, they have done usually one of two things. They have stayed single, that is, not living together, not cohabitating, and living separately, they then get married and traditionally enjoy the marriage, as the Christian does. Or they decide, as so often is the case in our culture, to cohabitate, live together first, and then say vows and get married. There's a huge difference in what happens to those couples who remain separate and get married, or cohabitate and get married. The percentage of couples who cohabitate first, live together first, then get married, and divorce after a 10-year period is 38%. 38% will divorce after a 10-year period. The number of those who live separately in our culture and then get married, not living together, and divorce for the first 10-year period is 27%. Which is interesting, because whenever I've talked to a person and I say, why are you living together before marriage? They say, well, we want to make sure first. You know, we want to test the merchandise. And if the merchandise seem really good, then we'll make the commitment. As if, they say, to avoid the divorce that they see, it works the other way around. It is based upon mistrust rather than trust. The trust of, we're committed till death do us part no matter what. Which seems, even by statistic, to be the best approach. Chapter 7 of 1 Corinthians, Paul dives into a touchy theme, but one that touches all of us, relationships. I use the term frequently, I think, irreducible minimum, but if you were to take life down to its irreducible minimum, I believe you have one word: relationships. Good ones or bad ones. You have a relationship with God or not. You have relationships with others or not. Strip away the finery, strip away what you own, what you drive, what your hobbies are, and really what life is made of is relationships. Relationships with God and with our fellow mankind on all the levels that they present is the source of greatest satisfaction and the source of the greatest agony. It's where people have the most problems. It's where people either have heaven on earth or hell on earth, depending on how we deal with them. At the time that Paul wrote the letter to the Corinthians, marriage was a big problem within the church. That's why he takes the time that he does in the next couple chapters to touch on marriage and singleness and divorce and remarriage and all of the thinking going on in the Christian church regarding those relationships. Marriage was a problem then, and take it from a guy who's dealt with a lot of different people's relationships over the last several years, it's still a huge problem. One person was right when he wrote, "We fall in love with a personality, but we must live with a character." Marriage is, most of you know, a very hot item today. In fact, that's where books and tapes sell, and radio broadcasts sell, for lack of a better term. Just on pure marketing, that's what touches most people. It's a hot area, because it's the area where, frankly, a lot of us just have a lot of problems. I get letters all the time about it, and it seemed that Paul did too. Corinthians is written in response to questions that the Corinthian church asked Paul, and one of them was concerning marriage, singleness, divorce, remarriage. The whole relationship issue, the one man, one woman relationship thing, was a big issue that they wrote Paul and asked advice for, so that 1 Corinthians is a response letter based upon what Paul thinks and what God says about this issue, what God says about several others that we'll speak about in subsequent chapters. So 1 Corinthians, Paul is replying to definite questions about marriage relationship. Caution, warning, clue. 1 Corinthians 7 is not a systematic theology on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. It's part of it, but there's a lot of other texts we must bring to bear to get God's full scope, including Genesis 2. But it's part of the puzzle. It is primarily Paul answering specific questions related to the subject. And one of the questions, and we'll deal with that first off in the first few verses, is singleness, staying single. Is it more spiritual to get married? Is it more spiritual to remain single? Those were issues they were asking about. Now, the text that I read out of is always the New King James Version, but before I do, I want to read some of these verses in an entirely different translation, probably one that you don't have in your lap right now. It's a freer translation. I'll warn you in advance. It's called The Message. It's an excellent free translation by Eugene Peterson. Now, getting down to the questions you asked in your letter to me. First, is it a good thing to have sexual relations? Certainly, but only within a certain context. It's good for a man to have a wife and for a woman to have a husband. Sexual drives are strong, but marriage is strong enough to contain them and provide for a balanced and fulfilling sexual life in a world of sexual disorder. The marriage bed must be a place of mutuality, the husband seeking to satisfy his wife, the wife seeking to satisfy her husband. Marriage is not a place to stand up for your rights. Marriage is a decision to serve the other, whether in bed or out. Abstaining from sex is permissible for a period of time if you both agree to it, and if it's for the purpose of prayer and fasting. But only for such times, then come back together again. Satan has an ingenious way of tempting us when we least expect it. I'm not, understand, commanding these periods of abstinence, only providing my best counsel if you should choose them. Sometimes I wish everyone were single like me, a simpler life in many ways, but celibacy is not for everyone any more than marriage is. God gives the gift of the single life to some, the gift of the married life to others. That's his take on it. That's his rendering on it. Now we're going to go through it in our text in a moment. It will help you to understand 1 Corinthians 7 if I can help paint the picture of what was prevalent in that day and age. You need to understand a little bit about Greco-Roman culture and trends so that you understand why they would even ask such questions. So I want to paint that picture and give you four trends that were very common in ancient times. The ancient Greco-Roman society, that's the background of which Paul wrote. Number one, there were no set laws of marriage in the Roman culture. In fact, there were four different ways that people got married back in ancient Roman culture. And this was the time of the Roman Empire where Paul was writing. Way number one was called in the Roman tongue Cante Bernium, which meant tent companionship. This was for slaves. This is how it worked. Half of the Roman Empire were slaves. Up to 60 million people were slaves out of about 120 million. Many of the Christians came out of a background of slaves, so this touched them right where they lived. In this Cante Bernium, or this tent companionship, the owner of a slave may allow the slave to live with another one, to cohabitate and call that a marriage as long as it pleased the owner. At any time, he could throw the wife out or the husband out because he owned the slave. So that was for the low class, the slaves. A second thing was the common law marriage. We have them today, but in ancient Roman times, if you lived with a person after 1 year of living together, it was considered by Roman law to be a bona fide marriage relationship. So you had the slave marriage, you had the common law marriage. A third thing you had was called coemptio in manum, which is marriage by sale. A father could sell his daughter to a young suitor if he had the bucks. And the prettier she was, the more dad would charge. You say, that's appalling, and it is, but that was part of what was called patria potestas, the absolute rule of the father in the Roman household. He had absolute control over his house, and he would call it a dowry, but basically sell off his daughter to a man. The fourth type of marriage is what you and I know. It was the first-class marriage. It was for the high citizen, the high Roman citizen. And it was the wedding ceremony, called in the Roman tongue, conferatio, where they had a Roman ceremony very similar to our modern-day ceremony. Maybe so. In fact, almost every element of our modern wedding ceremony comes from ancient pagan Roman customs. Now, I've heard somebody say, oh no, it all comes from ancient Judaism. I don't know what books you're reading, but it does not. Everything does. In fact, there was the bride had a maid or a matron of honor that came in with her bearing flowers, a bouquet of flowers. The groom had a best man that came to the place of the ceremony. Vows were exchanged. A ring was placed on the same finger because the Romans, in dissecting human bodies, believed that a nerve ran directly from this finger to the heart. That's why the ring is put on this finger. They even went to another place and had a cake, had a party. The veil, everything was from the ancient Roman times. That's how they conducted their ceremonies. The only difference is they had a seven-day party, a seven-day reception. Huge feast that lasted a week, 7 days, whereas today to get an engagement to last 7 days is a stretch sometimes. So the big difference. That was trend number one. There was no fixed marriage laws. It all varied depending on who you were in your class. Trend number two, rampant immorality and divorce. Men had wives and concubines and left their wives for new wives and left their wives for other wives. And wives did the same thing with husbands, according to Roman culture. In fact, there are records that show people who have been divorced 28 times. So that it sort of became a joke among the Romans that you could count a person's years by the number of spouses they've had. Rampant immorality, rampant divorce. Now, even among the Jews who had the highest ideal of marital relationships, there were problems. Because though Jews said you ought to get married, when it came to divorce, there were two schools of thought. There was Rabbi Shammai, he was the conservative rabbi, who said you don't divorce for any reason except for sexual immorality. Then there was young Rabbi Hillel, who was the liberal of the day, and said, oh, well, you know, he was interpreting Deuteronomy 24. Remember that text where Moses said, if a husband finds some point of uncleanness in his wife, he should write her a certificate of divorce, and these things should happen. Hillel said that that uncleanness could be very broad. For instance, if the woman spins around for joy in the streets publicly, that's grounds for divorce. Hillel said that. If she's a brawling woman at home, grounds for divorce. If she talks publicly to another man, grounds for divorce. And other rabbis even took that in the ilk of Hillel and broadened it further. You know, if she prepares his food wrong, grounds for uncleanness. So there became a problem even among the very religious people who were, in the name of the Bible, divorcing for these kinds of reasons. A third trend at that time, a very strong feminist movement. Did you know that in Rome? A strong vocal feminist movement in Rome because Rome fostered that kind of thinking. Women were competing with men in businesses. Women were even competing with men in physical feats, wrestling matches. And it seemed that this trend became very vocal as the Roman Empire went on, and women basically said, I don't want to get married and have children. And many of them said, because kids change the shape of your body, I don't want them. And it was a I want what I want kind of a philosophy. A fourth trend, and this is where it sort of hits home here. There's a backlash against all of these other trends in the church, where you had a group of Christians who thought they were very spiritual because they said, well, then we just shouldn't get married. If you're really spiritual, you'll stay single forever. Of course, that trend in some churches has even continued among some. If you're really spiritual, you'll remain celibate. In fact, this group would condemn others who were married, so that some of the married people thought they should leave their mates, especially if they were married to somebody they didn't like an unbeliever. This is their chance to get out and be spiritual. Of course, Paul wrote about this, 1 Timothy 4, about those who were forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from foods. So that's the background. It helps paint the picture. Those were the four trends going on. Now look at verse 1. Now concerning the things of which you wrote me, see, he's responding to a question, an issue. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband. Here's the first point. And Paul will bring out 4 points about this in the first 7 verses. Point number 1, celibacy, singleness, is good. Nothing wrong with it. It is good, he says, for a man not to touch a woman. And this is in the context of a sexual relationship. It's okay. It's good to be single, to be unmarried. Listen to that verse in the Amplified Version. Clears it up. It is good not to touch a woman, but to remain unmarried. Now listen to it again in the Weist translation. I've told you about that before. It's a literal Greek translation. It is perfectly proper, honorable, and morally befitting for a man to live in strict celibacy. Now understand what he's saying. He's saying, it's okay to be single. It's not commanded, but it's okay. It's good. It's not the only good. It's not the highest good, but it's good. It couldn't be the only good, could it? Because God in Genesis 2 said, hey, it's not good that man should be alone. I'm going to make a helper that's suitable for him. And that's where marriage developed, as God saw that the norm was, the general overarching rule of society was, singleness isn't good. First of all, you couldn't have a society, could you? Unless people got married and had babies. But Paul is sort of relieving the pressure. It's good. Nothing wrong with celibacy. It's okay to be single. Don't feel guilty because of it. And that's important because the issue is brought up. Is it more spiritual to be single or to be married? Paul said, well, nothing wrong with it. It's good. It's okay. He will go on to say it's not the only good. It's simply one of the gifts that God gives. The Jewish people believed, it's not in the scripture, but they taught in their own Talmudic writings, that if you really want to be right with God, you will be married. If you're not married, something's wrong with you, you're not right with God. The Jews had a list of 7 people who would not go to heaven. Number 1 on the list, a Jew, a man, a Jewish man who has no wife. 2nd on the list, a man and woman that have no child. Can you imagine that? Of course, this isn't biblical, but that's their thinking. And it is still the thinking, maybe not that radical, of people today. If people say, I'm single, I've never gotten married. Well, how old are you? Well, I'm in my 30s or 40s. Are you weird? Is something goofy with you? Maybe not. It could be a gift from God. It could be a calling from God. Paul says it's okay. But our society, typically, traditionally, our church society, I should say, has taken a low view of people who are single over a long period of time. There's a lot of fine Christian women around here, you know, you ought to find one. Listen to this article out of the New York Times a few years back by some, well, ultra-conservative wacko, I think, who wrote this. You'll understand when I read it. Quote, he says, the single man is disposed to criminality, drugs, and violence. He is irresponsible about his debts. He's alcoholic. He is accident-prone and venereally diseased. Unless he can marry, he is destined to an unsteady life, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short-lived. Isn't that encouraging? Now, he says, concerning the things that you wrote to me, it's good, don't feel guilty, it's not evil, to be celibate, to be single. In fact, we'll find out it's a gift. I would like you at this point to turn to Matthew chapter 19. Because Jesus speaks about this, and did you know that the disciples came to a point where they even thought it's more spiritual not to get married? It's more spiritual to be single. Look at Matthew chapter 19. Now it came to pass, when Jesus finished these sayings, that he departed from Galilee and came to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan, and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him, saying to him, is it lawful for a man to divorce for just any reason? Divorce his wife for any reason? Now you know why they were asking that. Because of the debate between Rabbi Shammai, who said, oh no, only for sexual immorality, and Rabbi Hillel, and later Akiba, who said, well, you know, if she's a brawling woman, or doesn't cook right, or talks to men in the street, that kind of stuff, yeah, it's unclean, get rid of her. So there's this debate going on between basically the guys who want to dump their wives and those who don't. And he answered and said, have you not read, don't you love Jesus' answer? Don't you spiritual leaders ever read the Bible? That he who made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then, they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. They said to him, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and put her away? He said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted, not commanded, you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. Now listen to the disciples' reaction. They're going, whoa, that's narrow. That's tight, man. That's stiff. Listen to their response. His disciples said, if such is the case of the man with his wife, it's better not to marry. They said, beg marriage if that's the case. Because we see a lot of folks that don't get along. Now, notice Jesus teaching immediately following that carnal revelation to the disciples. He said to them, all cannot accept this saying. What saying? Well, it's better not to get married. All cannot accept this saying, but only to those, and notice this, to whom it has been what? Given. It means it's a gift. For there are eunuchs who were born thus from their mother's womb. Some by congenital defect cannot regenerate, reproduce life. They're born that way. Something happens in the sexual organs, and in the ancient term, they're eunuchs from birth. And there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men. Now, you almost have to have lived in that culture to understand that the court eunuch, the keeper of the harem for the king, was often castrated. He was rewarded by riches, but he was castrated because of obvious reasons. He's controlling a harem. And that was typical in the pagan cultures of the day. They were made that way by men. And there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. That is, they have voluntarily remained single for a lifetime. It's a gift from God. They do it to expand the kingdom. And notice Jesus says, he who is able to accept it, let him accept it. So, it's not a curse from God to be single. Paul says it's good. Jesus says it's a gift. Now, I know some of you are thinking right now, God, please don't give that gift to me. There's a lot of gifts I like, but I don't want that one. Can I ask for a show of hands? How many tonight, since there's nothing wrong with being married or single, how many are single? Raise your hand. Okay. How many single are here tonight that want to get married sometime in your life? Go ahead, raise them up high. Keep them up for a minute. Now look around. Quickly, look at all the people that have their hands up. I helped you a little bit. Got you a little head start on who's single and wants to be married. Now, let me just say, you raised your hand and you said, someday I want to get married. Let me announce to you, you don't have this gift of singleness. Because God would equip you if he gave that to you. Some have a gift. Not all can receive this saying. Only to those to whom it has been given. Paul says it's good. It's not evil. Jesus said only those who can accept it are that way. I have met people who are great servants of the Lord, who by the calling of God, though it is not the norm, it is still good, they've decided to be single. Are they more spiritual? No. Are they less spiritual? No. But they are spiritual. I've met women in India completely dedicated to the single life so that they can reach other single abused women in the slums of Calcutta and New Delhi and Bombay. That's their ministry, to reach out to abused single women. And they've dedicated themselves to that and they believe they have the gift. I know missionaries in the field in Jordan who've given their life for service and they're not tempted. They're out there. That's what God called them to do as a single person. Dr. John Stott, who was the rector of All Souls Church, the pastor for many years in London and is still the pastor emeritus. I was with him over in Amsterdam this last week. He's been single all his life. God's given him the gift. He's devoted himself to writing and to preaching. Not everybody can accept it, but some can, and it can be a beautiful gift of God. However, the church often says, something's wrong with you. You're a little weird. You ought to be married. Maybe. Maybe not. I agree with Mark Lee, who wrote these words. The general society holds that normal people are either married or want to be, but that the single status is not an appropriate option to marriage. Singles may have been a greater object of neglect than even our families. The church ought to draw singles into the life of the church. Singles should be accepted. All persons live for a time as single people. So it must be a normal state. Happily married people were once happily single people. Now, food for further thought on this, just to plant something in your mind. How do you be a successful single person in this day and age? And let me just commend to you the character of Daniel. A young man in a pagan culture could have done anything he wanted to do and was even asked to do it. But three things kept him. Number one, he refused to let the world shape him into its mold. He purposed in his heart not to defile himself with the king's food. Number two, he devoted himself completely to the will of God. And number three, he had a network of friends around him that he relied on. Godly friends that could encourage him. Let's move on to the second point now in verse 2, since it's taken a half an hour to get to verse 1. His second point here is that being single is good, but there is temptation. It is a temptable position. Nevertheless, verse 2, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband. Now, some look at that and say, what a rotten view of marriage. Yeah, you know, it's good to stay single, but you know, because so that you don't have improper sexual relations, get married. That is not his point. He is addressing those who have said it's more spiritual to be single. Paul's saying it's not more spiritual to be single. It's not even the norm. The norm is to be married. And he realizes that not everybody has this gift. So to those people who would say, you know, everybody should be single, he's saying everybody can't be single. The desire is too strong, man. And you guys who live in Corinth, of all places, who walk down the street, you're in Temptationville. Hello. There's the temple of Aphrodite and the prostitutes that come out and solicit the men. And there's that constant possibility of temptation. So he realizes that some have the gift, it is good, but that the norm, though one isn't necessarily better than the other, is that one man, one woman relationship. And so he says, nevertheless, because of that temptation, sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife and each woman have her own husband. Here's a simple way to look at it. No one should ever attempt a way of life that deliberately places he or she in temptation. Never attempt a way of life that deliberately places a person in line of temptation. Now, that doesn't mean you run out and marry the first thing that breathes. I'm a man, you're a woman, God's up there. Let's get married, shall we? Do you know God? I think, good enough. Let's pray. Boom, get married. No. Because marriage for the sake of sexual gratification isn't any way to base a relationship. And again, take the balance of Scripture. Ephesians chapter 5. Marriage is to be a reflection of Christ and the church. That sacrifice, that devotion, that nurturing that takes place within a relationship. Both are gifts. If you're single, it's a gift. If you're single for a lifetime, it's a gift. If you're married, it's a gift. The problem is this. The problem is when single people try to live like married people, and married people try to live like single people. Then you got problems, and that's one of the problems going on here. I'll show that in a minute. But the issue isn't, are you single or are you married? The question is, are you his? And will you live that relationship to the max, to the fullest? I'm his as a single person, or I'm his as a married person. With all of the advantages that each has, I live unto the Lord for his glory. That is the issue. Because Paul says both are gifts from God. Let's go on to the third point in verses 3 through 5. And that is, a single lifestyle is wrong if you're married. A single lifestyle is wrong if you're married. Point number one, celibacy, singleness is okay. Number two, singleness is okay, but there's temptation involved, so you got to make sure you're called to it. Number three, the single lifestyle is wrong if you're a married person. Remember one of the first tenets in Genesis 2. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and what? Cleave unto his wife. You know that the word means to be glued inseparably. There's that oneness that takes place. When a married person says, yeah, I'm married, but, you know, I'm used to doing things my way, and I've always had things done this way, and I want to keep going with that. And you start living like you used to live rather than as you should live as a married person, then there are problems. Look at verse 3. Let the husband, and he just touches on one aspect of this, render to his wife the affection due her. And likewise, the wife to her husband. Notice he does not single out one or the other. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now let me read Eugene Peterson's take on this one more time, just those verses in his translation called The Message. The marriage bed is to be a place of mutuality. The husband seeking to satisfy his wife, the wife seeking to satisfy her husband. You see that the marriage relationship is this: I'm not in it for me, I'm in it for you. Marriage is not a place to stand up for your rights. Marriage is a decision to serve the other, whether in bed or out. Abstaining from sex is permissible for a period of time if you both agree to it, and if it's for the purpose of prayer and fasting, but only for such times, then come back together again. Satan has an ingenious way of tempting us when we least expect it. Some, it seems, believed that even though they were married, it was more spiritual to abstain from sexual relations, to try to be celibate while being married. And the thinking, believe it or not, and I have to say, though it's rare, I have met people today that have that warped view of sex and marriage. Well, it's only for procreation, and once the kids come, then there's no need for it. Oh, listen, that ain't in the Bible. Understand, that ain't in the Bible. Ain't in the Bible either, but I just thought I'd share that with you. But it's not there. Hebrews says this: marriage is honorable among all, and the bed is undefiled. Genesis 2, God made the male and female, and then he said, this is very good. And the man and his wife were both naked, and they were what? Unashamed. Not ashamed at all. It was good. Then there's Solomon, Who can pass over the Song of Solomon in bringing up this point? The whole context of that Bible book, the Song of Solomon, is a young husband, the king of Judea, and this unsophisticated farmer gal from the northern part of Israel, the wooing of the relationship and the wedding and their wedding time together, and it's in praise of physical love for each other. Now, I understand that many people have tried to see this purely as a metaphor of love for Christ in the church. That would only be a secondary interpretation. Primarily, it's a husband looking at his wife and commending her and praising her and loving her in that outflow of physical love and vice versa. Allow me, would you, to read a portion of the Song of Solomon so that you get the flavor of it and you understand that to think, I'm married, but we're not going to have sexual relation because it's more spiritual, ain't in the scripture. Okay? This is Song of Solomon, chapter 5 in the Living Bible. The wife looks upon her husband. My beloved one is tanned and handsome, better than 10,000 others. His head is purest gold, and he has wavy raven hair. His eyes are like doves beside the water brooks, deep and quiet. His cheeks are like sweetly scented beds of spices. His lips are perfumed lilies, his breath like myrrh. His arms are round bars of gold, set with topaz. His body is bright ivory, encrusted with jewels. His legs are pillars of marble, set in sockets of the finest gold. Like cedars of Lebanon, none can rival him. His mouth is altogether sweet, lovely in every way. Then she, after saying that to him, he responds, as Solomon sees his wife in chapter 7, "How beautiful your tripping feet, O queenly maiden, your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of the most skilled of craftsmen. Your navel is lovely as a goblet filled with wine. Your waist is like a heap of wheat set about with lilies. Your two breasts are two fawns, yes, lovely twins. You are tall and slim like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters of dates. I said, I will climb into the palm tree and take hold of its branches." That's the Bible. Husbands and wives, have you ever talked that way to each other? You could quote the scripture. Who knows what might happen? Here's the point I want to make. God made your body. He designed you. He made every part of you, even the sexual parts. You are designed to be stimulated within the confines and the context of God's laws. It's God-given. Of course, it must be God-governed, but it is God-given. C.S. Lewis was right. Pleasure is God's invention, not the devil's. Listen, the master architect built a wonderful nervous system into you. And all of that you shouldn't be ashamed of. Husband and wife, Genesis 2, naked, not ashamed. God said it is good. Now look closer at verse 3. Let the husband render to his wife the affection. Notice this word, do her. Likewise, the wife, her husband. Literally, it's this. Husband, render the debt due her. Or fulfill your duty to your wife and wife to your husband. Now here's a point that probably won't make some people happy, but I don't care because it's scripture and that's just my job to tell you what it means. You look carefully at this verse and the next verse and the next verse, 3, 4, and 5, and this is what it says. Sexual love in a marriage is a privilege. It's a pleasure. And it's a responsibility. It's a pleasure, it's a privilege, and it's a responsibility. And there's no distinction here, notice, between the man and the woman. The husband has no more rights than does the wife. In fact, Paul points to the husbands first and says, husbands, give your wife what is due her in that pleasure of relationship physically. Verse 4, the wife does not have authority over her own body. The husband does. And likewise, the husband doesn't have authority over his own body, but the wife does. So if there was somebody in Corinth who was trying to be super spiritual and saying to her husband, "Oh, honey, I love you, but I now belong to God and I can't do this any longer." Paul's saying that's wrong. You can't claim that you even own your own body. Your spouse does. Now, let's back off. Simply, in simple terms, You are the manager of your body. It's yours. You're to take care of it. It's the temple of the Holy Spirit. That's in the simple, basic, physical sense. In a spiritual sense, God is over your body. In a marital sense, if you're married, your spouse is. It's part of the nurturing, is this nurture of physical love. So you own each other's body, and the ring is simply a symbol of that. It's the signed transaction. I'm yours, honey. You're mine. And that's the symbol of it. A word of balance about this, however. Sex is to be based on love, not on selfishness. So it's kind of bad form, man, to try this on your wife. I own you, honey. The body is mine. Now come over here. Or for your wives to say that to husbands. It's to be based on love, to be sensitive. And here's the key. This is how it works the best. I live to serve you in the marriage. And for the spouse, the other one to say, and I live to serve you. I want to meet your needs. That's how it works beautifully. Enough said on that. Verse 5, do not deprive one another. Of what? Of sexual activity. That's the context of this thing. It's obvious. Except with consent for a time that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and then come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Let me put it bluntly. To refuse it, sexual activity in a marriage, is to, according to this, commit robbery. You're robbing that person. And you are opening the door to place that person in a position of temptation to seek satisfaction elsewhere, because God has designed that person to have needs met as well. So that's why it says, don't deprive one another or rob, except for consent for a time. Don't ever use sex to manipulate your partner. Men and women I have seen do this. Sexual pleasure in marriage can be a tool to build one another up. It is not to be a weapon or a device to manipulate. Notice, it is only to be on mutual agreement. It is to only be temporary. It is to be for prayer on a specific thing. Maybe God lays something on your heart or you're making some big decision. And just like you would fast from food, there's this fasting from this activity that is normal and good and God-given, but I'm doing this to concentrate on what God is saying. Let me give you an example of how that worked in the Bible. We have an example in the Old Testament when the law was given on Mount Sinai and God was giving commands to Moses to tell the children of Israel how to receive the law. Exodus 19, God told Moses, go down and prepare the people for my visit. Purify them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothing. So Moses went down to the people. He purified them for worship, had them wash their clothes, and he told them, get ready for an important event 2 days from now. And until then, abstain from sexual intercourse. It was that fasting to devote myself to this covenant of God. But to prolong that in a marriage can cause bitter resentment, angry and evil thoughts. And I have seen sometimes, now understand what I'm saying. Don't go off and say, he said something I'm not saying. At the root, at the base of some adulterous relationships, at the base of some adulterous relationships is a spouse who refuses to pleasure the partner in a marriage relationship and places that other person in the middle of temptation. And according to Paul, you become an agent of Satan when you do it. Notice the words here. So that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. We are not to withhold. Fourth point, and we'll conclude with the next two verses. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. For I wish that all men were even as myself. But each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and the other in that. Now, it sounds obvious, but some unravel these two verses a little bit different from another. Some believe, as Eugene Peterson believes, you read and you heard his translation, that what Paul is saying is, I'm not commanding you to abstain physically during your time of prayer, but only if you want to. That's how he renders it. I happen, though, I respect him to disagree with his rendering on that. I think Paul is speaking in the broader context of marriage and singleness, that he's saying, I'm not commanding you to get married if you're single, because I said it was good. I'm not commanding you to get married, just to be aware of your needs, depending on who you are. Be aware of your needs. I'm not commanding everyone to marry. Marriage is the norm. It's the foundation of society. But if you don't get married and you're single, you're not a second-class citizen. I think that's his point. Your spirituality is not based on your marital relationship. In fact, truth be known, I know many married people that act way more immature than a lot of single people. It's not like you reach some pinnacle of maturity. You can stay a baby and be married forever. So your spirituality and mine has nothing to do with our marital status, whether you're single or you're married. God isn't commanding you to get married. God isn't commanding you to be single. Both are a gift. Notice that Paul says, I wish that all men were even as myself. Which brings up the question, we know that at this time, or we're pretty sure that Paul was single. But the question people have is, was Paul always single? Was he ever married? The general belief is that Paul at one time was married, split up from his wife, and continued as a Christian believer, New Testament preacher, as a single man the rest of his life, but that at one time he was married. The reason that is the consensus is because he was a member of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish court, the highest ruling body among the Jews. According to the Babylonian Talmud, in the Tractate Sanhedrin 36b, that's where you find it if you want to look in it, says that to be a member of the Sanhedrin, you have to be both married and have children. So people put it together and go, oh, well, if the Talmud says you have to be married and have kids, and Paul was probably married and he had kids. Clement of Alexandria, one of the early church fathers, though he could never prove it, he said that he believed Paul was married and that he left his wife at the church at Philippi because of his travel schedule. And so they sort of separated and he just lived the single lifestyle, though she stayed and served the Lord in that capacity at Philippi. But there's absolutely no proof of that. Furthermore, the Sanhedrin tractate of the Babylonian Talmud that I just quoted was written at the end of the first century, beginning of the second century, after the days of Paul. So it was not a mandate when he was around. So it could be that Paul always was single. We don't know that. Really unimportant. The point is he's single here, right, when he writes this. And he's simply saying, if you're single, that can be a gift that God gives to you and calls you to the rest of your life, just like he could do it if you're married. Now, here I am, I'm single. And in a sense, I could wish that everyone was single just like I am, because there are some advantages. Look down to verse 32. We'll peek ahead. You'll see some of those advantages. But I want you to be without care. He who is unmarried cares for the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. You understand what he's saying, don't you? Marriage brings certain natural, imperative preoccupations. You gotta care for your wife and nurture her and think about her needs and think about your children and the house and their schooling and things that you ought to do. Whereas if you're single, man, you can be just totally on one vibe for Jesus Christ. Freedom to move around, keep your own schedule, go do whatever you want whenever you want. Now, if you're saying, well, I'm married and I do that, then you got a problem. Because you ought to devote yourself to your wife and consider the things of this world that would please your wife and your children and provide for them, as the Bible in other places says. But you can see the natural advantages of just being totally set apart. So, first point, celibacy is good. Singleness is good. It's not evil. Nothing wrong with it. Second point, singleness is good, but you can be really tempted. So be careful. And if God hasn't called you to it, there's no shame in being married. Those natural desires, those physical desires are God-given. Just make sure they're God-governed. Third point, the single lifestyle is wrong if you're married. You adopt a whole new value system. And fourth, both singleness and marriage are gifts. So don't assume a person is weird if he or she says, no, I'm not married. No, I haven't gotten married. Yes, I am this age. It could be a gift from God. Now, if you're preoccupied with getting married, You don't got the gift. Don't worry about it. It is a gift, though, think about it, to be single and not consumed or preoccupied with a physical drive. That's a gift. And Jesus said, only to those to whom it has been given. H.L. Mencken wrote insightfully these words, "It is impossible to believe that the same God who permitted his own son to die a bachelor regards celibacy as a sin." Beautifully put. What gift has God given you? Use it to the max. Are you married? Find out how your marriage can best serve the Lord. How that you can come to a place where you are so gelled together that the relationship doesn't have so many thorns that you're always working on all the time, all your life, so that in total love and service, you can be honed instruments for God as a married couple. Aquila and Priscilla, good example. And there are others. If you're single, serve the Lord. Don't be preoccupied with anything but God's work. And let God give his gifts and his time. If you are single, I want to close with this. It was written by a single woman who wrote a book on the subject. And she wrote a little thing called "I Gave God Time." She wrote, "I gave God time and room and space. He worked to create in me, his child, a more quiet and centered place. A deeper route of peace and trust. He never fails to come through. Jesus, if this is your will, then yes to being single. In my deepest heart, I want to marry, to belong to a great man, to know that I am linked to his life and he to mine, following Christ in our dreams together. But you know what I need, Lord. And if I never marry, then I say yes to you." You can say that yes to him, whether you're single or married.